Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Captain Bob Jaspers, and he'll be answering your most important questions on sight fishing the flats of the Indian River Lagoon. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you would like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Captain Bob Jaspers about sight fishing the flats of the Indian River Lagoon. Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and helped with the Striped Bass Game Fish 2006 Symposium in Foxborough, Massachusetts last year, just to name a few. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Bob, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to the homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Bob's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We're also going to be doing something a bit different tonight. We're going to be giving away a $20 gift certificate, which can be redeemed for any merchandise at Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado, either online on their website or in their shop. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage, the same place that you can ask questions at. So listen closely and use your best typing skills when the time comes and give us your answer. And the first person, we'll let Bob judge whether you got the answer right or not at the end of the show. So stay tuned and pay attention. Well, tonight our guest is Captain Bob Jaspers. Bob is a full-time professional inshore sight fishing guide and third-generation native with over 35 years of local on-the-water experience, specializing in sight fishing the shallow grass flats in the northern areas of the Indian River Lagoon system. Bob has spent decades perfecting his own sight fishing style and techniques to simplify flats fishing to its most basic terms. Highly conservation-minded, he is extremely knowledgeable about East Central Florida portion of the upper Indian River Lagoon system and Florida's fish, flora, and fauna. For the past decade, he was involved in planting hundreds of thousands of mangroves along the Brevard County area's Indian River Lagoon shoreline, and is still involved in a continuing effort to clean the shoreline of the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge. Much of his youth was spent in the great outdoors surrounding Titusville, including the waters, marshes, and woodlands of the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge and the Playa Linda Beach, now owned by NASA and part of Canaveral National Seashore, and wandering the shoreline and backwaters of the St. Johns River and our 3 actual lagoons, the Banana River, the Upper River, Indian River, and the Mosquito Lagoon. He became an angler and later a fly fishing guide because of his love and respect for the Indian River Lagoon system. He believes strongly in its preservation and ecological success, which are vital to the survival of all its plant life, fish, and waters. Bob Jaspers is a member of the Indian River Guides Association, an amateur naturalist, a trained horticulturist, a bromeliad grower and collector, and a past Florida certified nursery professional. Bob, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here, and I appreciate you inviting me to come.
Well, let's talk about what we're going to talk about tonight, which is the Indian River Lagoon System, which involves several different lagoons and river systems, and we'll talk about the area, how it's laid out. We'll talk about the fish that are available in the area, and then we'll talk about how to fish for those fish, the flies, the tactics, the strategies, and things like that. So, Bob, let's start by, well, we have an international audience, and so let's start by telling people where in the world is the Indian River Lagoon System.
Okay, the Indian River Lagoon System encompasses 156 miles of shoreline along the east central and southeast part of Florida. I'm located in Brevard County, which is the Space Coast, and most people are probably familiar with Kennedy Space Center. And I grew up in Titusville, which is right across the Indian River from Kennedy Space Center.
Okay.
Okay.
And we're mid-eastern central Florida, basically.
Basically.
And
we're about 50 miles south of Daytona Beach. And the county I live in is Brevard County. There's four counties that pretty much surround this area of the upper northern part of the Indian River Lagoon where I'm at. And two of them are Brevard County and Volusia County, which is to our north. And then the other two are Orange County, and they're just, you know, maybe 60 miles away. But most of our anglers come from those four different counties.
Okay. Now, folks, we did put links out to two maps that might help you as we talk about this area tonight. And if you go to Bob's speakers page, which you can reach from our homepage where it says more about Bob Jaspers, just click on that, and near the bottom of his bio there, you will find a couple links to two different maps that might help you orient yourself in that area. So I just want to make mention of that before we got started too far into things here. Okay, well, Bob, tell us a bit about the there's really basically three main areas that we're going to be talking about tonight. Is that correct?
Right. We have, of course, the Indian River, the upper part of it, which dead ends up here in roughly about 5 miles or more north of Titusville. It, in turn, is connected by a canal called Holliver Canal that runs east from the northern part of the river to Mosquito Lagoon. And then south of there, connected to, in the northern area, connected to the Indian River is the Banana River Lagoon, which is connected by a barge canal in Brevard County up in the north area, and then probably about, I don't know, 30, 40 miles south of here is actually where the Banana River peels off to the east from the Indian River. So really none of this area is a river per se. There is no current. It's an estuary area. Most people may not know what an estuary is. So an estuary is a place where basically fresh water from a river mixes with salt water from the ocean. They're called bays, sounds, lagoons, inlet harbors, whatever. We call them lagoons here. It's not a true estuary compared to, say, the estuaries up in the Hatteras area, because we're not really connected to the ocean that much. We have a couple inlets, but for the most part, the entire area of Indian River Lagoon is not have a lot of access to the ocean. Here in my area, we have to the north Ponce Inlet, and in South Brevard County at the county line is Sebastian Inlet. From where I'm at, both of those are approximately 45 miles in either direction. So we get very little water inflow at all, if any, from those areas. We have a lock here at Port Canaveral, right by just about 5 miles north of Cocoa Beach, but it doesn't really exchange enough water to even be measurable, to tell you the truth. They tried it a couple times. It didn't work out. So we're pretty much landlocked. But in a way, that's a really good situation because it's created a unique situation for our red drum fishery. And we, because our red drums don't go out into the ocean here to breed, they breed in the river, so we have a pretty good population, a pretty good size red drum, which some people call redfish, some people call puppy drums, some people call them channel bass. Here we call them redfish, but basically they're red drum from the croaker family.
Now, this, when you say there's very little water exchange, how does the water, there must be enough just to keep it fresh and...
It's a salt water. We have salt water here in the Indian River Lagoon. It's better described as brackish. Averages in my area from 20 to 30 parts per thousand. Some places, of course, where rivers and creeks and stuff come in, it's a little less. It can be as low as 10 parts per thousand, but that's actually 30 parts per thousand is pretty much prime redfish salinity, and it raises and lowers at different times. It's really affected by evaporation and rain. Our water levels are controlled by rain and then evaporation, and the water can evaporate very quickly here. We can go a foot down in a week.
Just from evaporation?
Yes. Yes, so it creates some challenges that way. Of course, some places you'll fish it, you know, 1 month, might be too shallow the next month. It depends on what you're looking for, too. If you like big fish, you're going to fish the drop-off areas where it's a little deeper. The smaller fish are up closer to shore where it's smaller or shallower, excuse me. And well, some people really like to target the smaller fish, slot fish to eat, so that, you know, they have boats, you know, that they can get into those areas with.
Is the fishing equivalent in all three areas, in the Indian River, the Mosquito, and the No Motor? Is it different kind of fishing?
Traditionally it was. They all hold pretty much the same species. As far as productivity, years gone by, up, you know, in the 60s and beyond, there were just tons of fish everywhere. But as time has gone by and decades have passed, fishing's not as good, and, you know, we had gill net problems here, and it's a little less than it used to be. The northern part of Mosquito Lagoon right now is probably the fishiest place around. Northern part of the Indian River, fairly well. Banana River has its good spots. We have a lot of beautiful, beautiful, pristine seagrass beds around here in flats, and they're large. The farther south you get, they get smaller and smaller until you get about three counties down and there just aren't any at all. You're talking about a 20-foot grass flat. Well, here we have grass flats that are 1,000 yards wide. But we still have a good fishery here. Of course, there's a lot more fishing pressure than there used to be. So, and there's more people moving here all the time, so people are taking more fish, you know, to eat. And it is having its effect. But generally, we still have a good fish population here.
Now, has that, you had mentioned gill netting, did that affect some species more than others up there?
Yes, primarily. Well, the gill netters were after mullet. They were after the mullet. At first, when they first really started gill netting here, it was for a food source, but eventually it became, over time, we were just producing roe for the Japanese market, and the carcasses of the mullet were going to crab trappers. Of course, they had a bycatch permit that they were allowed to have, so a good portion of that was redfish. I don't know the exact poundage that they were allowed, but I've sat on the grass flats and watched gill netters with 3-mile-long gill nets just pull in one giant redfish after the other for hours. So, yeah, it's had an effect. But the gill net ban that was passed in 94 and implemented in 95 has helped that a lot. It's taking a while for it to get back to, you know, better numbers of fish, and I don't know if we'll ever, because of the population explosion here in this part of Central Florida, I don't know if we'll ever see the numbers that were here, you know, in the 60s, 50s, and before that, but things are getting better. And we're protecting our breeder fish, which are the bigger redfish, and that helps a lot because without breeders, you have no fry and you have no juvenile fish. So it affected the tarpon to a great extent, too. We had large tarpon coming into the area in Titusville where I grew up, which don't do that anymore. But we're seeing signs now this year of some of them coming back. But it's not in any amount that you can really target or promise anybody anything yet. We do have sporadic juvenile tarpon coming here in the spring and stay all summer long. So it fluctuates year to year. That we never see the same amount of tarpon here. And the same goes for the beach. The big tarpon, they're a lot more prevalent down in the southeast part of Florida. But we get them coming up following the mullet runs, both directions.
Now, what about the bottom structure and the, you know, the topography in these lagoons? What's it like? What are we fishing over there?
Well, it's primarily grass, seagrasses. We have seven different seagrasses here in Brevard County and in the Indian River Lagoon. Majority of it is manatee grass, Cuban shoal grass, and turtle grass here in my area. But we do have all seven here in some numbers or other. Some areas are manatee grass or Cuban shoal grass spotted with sand, like white sands, almost a coquina type of rock sand spots. Other places are just miles and miles of thick grass. Those areas are a little harder to wade. You might, you know, when you're walking, generally when you're walking on seagrass around here, you're talking about sinking 5 to 6 inches in the water. If you can find a sandy spot, you don't sink at all, hardly maybe an inch or two. And then we have muddy areas. They're primarily in Mesquite Lagoon, and some of them places are, you can sink down to your waist. So you have to be careful, you know, when you first step into the water in some places in Mesquite Lagoon, because it all looks the same till you step into it. And there's not always a lot of people around the shoreline that, you know, can come pull you out. I've heard some horror stories over the years of people that have sat in the mud up to their chest for hours until they finally figured out how to get themselves out of the water because nobody was coming to rescue them.
Boy, yeah. And what about tides? Are there any tides to worry about there then?
There are no tides here.
Okay.
Meteorological.
So if you get stuck, you don't have to worry about the water coming up to drown you anyway.
Right,
so.
Right. No, our water movement here is primarily based on wind, wind direction and speed. And, you know, if it blows from the same direction long enough, it'll push water into areas. We have a lot of bridges that cross the river here in different parts of this county alone. There's probably 5 or 6 of them. We call them causeways, but the bridges don't span the entire river. We have, the actual causeway is a landmass that they built coming off of East Shoreline where they dredged on either side to create fill dirt, and in the middle there's an actual bridge. So that in turn has slowed down the exchange of water quite a bit since those were built, and we don't see as much of water moving over large areas where nowadays we see it getting pushed up into the causeway areas and the corners and stuff like that. So you can, if you really know what you're looking for, you can notice a little bit of a depth change. But as far as tides, no. Mesquite Lagoon has maybe a 1-inch tide at the most in the very northern parts of it.
What is the depth, then, of these lagoons?
Well, Mesquite Lagoon's average depth is around 3 feet. There's deeper areas and there's shallower areas. The actual entire Indian River Lagoon system, 156 miles of it, average depth is 4 feet. We have dredged channels. We have the intercoastal waterway here, and that averages probably 10 to 11 foot. Some places it's filled in down to 8 foot. Underneath the causeway bridges, some places are a little deeper. There's one bridge we have here that's 30 foot deep, but that's because the wind is, you know, pushing all this water in between these land masses, the causeways themselves, and through the little opening area where the bridge is. So it stays pretty deep right underneath the bridges, which creates a good fishery for bait fishermen and stuff like that.
Now, there is, I take it, no oyster beds that you find in some of the areas there.
I'm sorry, could you say it again?
Yeah, are there any oyster beds within the lagoons?
Well, years gone by, we used to have a lot of oyster beds here. Right now, they're pretty much regulated to the northern part of Mesquite Lagoon, and that's probably caused by two reasons. One, people taking them and eating them, and the farther south you went, the less there were, so eventually they just aren't that many. You can see them on the shoreline and rocks some places, but not in any quantity that, you know, where you would want to harvest them. They're not very big. In Mesquite Lagoon, we have actual oyster beds that you have to be careful about because, you know, the farther north you get there, closer you get to Ponce Inlet, and then the tides start affecting you, so the beds will be exposed in some areas and not in others at different times.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like from the depth there that I would assume that wade access is pretty available there as far as walking in and wading.
There's all kinds of access for wade fishing here. It's unlimited, actually. Even though it's been built up a lot along the Indian River and the Banana River area especially, there's still a lot of places where you can, you know, walk off and into the water. Farther north you get, north of, like, say, Cocoa and the Cape Canaveral area, you have a lot more access spots to wade or pull a kayak or a canoe into the water because in the middle of those three lagoons, you have the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge, and there is no building on those shores. Now, part of that, a great part of it, is encompassed by Kennedy Space Center, and some of that we have no access to. So there are shorelines you can't even get out of your boat and walk on. But we have tons of access.
Okay. Now, do you normally fish from boats, or do you walk and wade?
Myself personally?
Yeah, and with your clients. And
yeah, I don't usually wade fish. When I have a client that likes to do that, then, sure, we'll jump in that water. I have no problem jumping in the water. I like to do it, especially in the summertime when it's really hot. So, but, no, I think you can be just as productive out of a boat or a canoe, which is what I fish out of, a flats boat, 16-foot flats boat, or I have also a 17-foot canoe, and I fish out of that quite a bit. And if you're quiet and stealthful in your approach, you can do pretty well out of a canoe or a flats boat.
Now, I know that no motors are allowed in that Banana River no motor zone. Maybe you want to explain that and then also talk about where you can use motors to get around with.
Well, we can use motors everywhere here but the Banana River no motor zone. There are no motors allowed on your boat in that particular no motor zone, unlike some no motor zones here in Florida where you're allowed to have a boat with a motor in there, but you have to pull the motor out of the water, tilt it up with your tilt and trim or whatever. Ours, there's no motors allowed whatsoever, and that includes electric trolling motors. So you are allowed to be out there in a canoe or a kayak or a sailboat, or any version of a sailboat you want to come up with, which I've seen quite a few interesting ones, but no boats with motors on them.
And what's the reasoning for that there?
Well, actually, the no motor zone is a manatee sanctuary created on the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge at the very northernmost upper part of the Banana River. At Port Canaveral, which is north of Cocoa Beach, the no motor zone starts. It goes from one causeway bridge to another, and approximately 7 miles. On the north end of that, from that causeway bridge, which we call the NASA Causeway Bridge, or State Road 405, everything on the other side of that is off limits. It's part of Kennedy Space Center, and that's where the actual manatee sanctuary is. So we have a pretty large area to fish out of. The western shoreline is 7 miles long from causeway bridge to bridge. The eastern side is around 5 miles. And it's a couple miles wide, so it's a pretty good size area.
And there's basically fish everywhere in all three areas, right?
Well, yes, there is. Oh, we have beautiful flats. We have miles and miles of them here. And like anywhere else, inshore fishery, every area doesn't have fish. It doesn't hold them regularly. But there are every area, every lagoon, Mesquite Lagoon, Banana River, and Indian River Lagoon up here, there are places that hold a lot of fish. You just it takes time to figure out where they're at.
Now, back to the boats for a second. I guess obviously if you have a canoe or a kayak, you can just put in wherever you'd like. What about public boat launch areas for flats boats and so forth?
We have a lot of boat ramps here. Even in Mosquito Lagoon, there's probably about, I would say just off the top of my head, six or seven of them. Some of them are pretty remote areas, and they may not be really safe places to leave your vehicles. But we also have parks, you know, run by the county and with boat ramps that are in great shape and kept up. And there's probably 20 of them around here. So we could always use more because the angler base in this area is growing by leaps and bounds every year. So none of us are ever going to turn down a new boat ramp. But we have a lot of boat ramps.
Yeah. You mentioned a lot of local people coming to fish there, you said, in the four or five county area, I guess, around you. But what about travelers coming in from out of state and so forth?
We have quite a few of those, too. This whole area, Brevard County, Mesquite Lagoon, are considered the redfish capital of the world. It's an advertising program that the state of Florida came through to promote fishing here. There's probably some areas like Louisiana and Texas that would want to dispute that claim, but 90% of my business is fly fishers from out of state. And I really enjoy Take Fly Anglers because they're just a great bunch of anglers. And I really like fishing with them. So over the years, I have kind of targeted my business to cater to them.
Okay.
We have hundreds of guides here, so there are people for everybody and every type of fishing they want to do. And we get a lot of them, especially in the winter.
Yeah. Does it get crowded out there, or is there plenty of room for everybody?
Yes, and at times it does. Weekends can be kind of rough, especially in holidays and on good weather days, spring, summer, and fall. Winter, it's a little less crowded. Mesquite Lagoon can get pretty crowded at times. We have over 100 guides now that are permitted to fish in Mesquite Lagoon. It's actually the northern part of Mesquite Lagoon is part of Canaveral National Seashore. The southern part is part of the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge. But because of the Canaveral Seashore being associated with it, it's a national park. So to do any kind of business in Mesquite Lagoon, you have to have an incidental business permit. And right now there are approximately 100 guides guiding in Mesquite Lagoon alone with that permit. So, yeah, it can get a little crowded, weekends especially.
Well, we need to take a little break here, Bob, so just give me 30 seconds here, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk to Bob more about fishing these flats of the lagoons. Pere Marquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop, and guide service located on the banks of the historic Pere Marquette River in Baldwin, Michigan, providing year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit www.pmlodge.com or call 231-745-3972. That's PM Lodge, that's like Pere Marquette Lodge, .com or call 231-745-3972. They hope to see you soon. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bob Jaspers about sight fishing the flats of the Indian River Lagoon. If you'd like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Bob, you have mentioned a little bit about your business guide service down there. Why don't you just take a minute and this is your opportunity to tell us what you do down there, the services you offer, and, And be sure to mention your website and your phone number there so people can get a hold of you.
Okay. I'm primarily a sight fishing guide. I grew up here in Titusville, Florida. I've kind of, over the years, morphed into a sight fishing guide. I started out like everybody else, using whatever was available, whatever would catch fish. But over the time, I've gotten more conservation-minded, and I'm pretty much what you would describe a catch-and-release artificial lure or fly guide. And pretty much what I do is pull the boat. My anglers that come with me, I don't fish with them. Some guides do. I don't. I pretty much concentrate on making their day as memorable as it can be and catch as many fish as they can. But I don't really concentrate on numbers. I'm more on quality than quantity. So I'm pretty much a big fish guide. I'm not really interested in chasing redfish that are under 30 inches. I haven't taken a picture of a redfish under 30 inches in probably 15 years. I target large redfish and large black drum, and anything else that comes in the way is just gravy, the way I look at it. So majority of my customers are looking to catch something big, because that's what I advertise to do.
What's your website address there, Bob?
My website is www.flatstime.com, and that's spelled FLATSTIME. My phone number is 321-626-0104. And all that information is on your site as well.
Right. Yeah. Right. If you go to Bob's speakers page, you'll find links to his website
right there. And if
you
anybody wants to contact me, write me emails or anything to ask questions, please feel free to do it. I answer questions like that every day on my email, so I have no problem with it.
Oh, good. Good. Appreciate that offer. Mike Adamson sent in a question that said, have you seen these waters change over the years, and what presents the greatest danger to them today, and what can we do to preserve them for future generations? So you being involved in that quite a bit, I'm sure you can speak to that.
Right. Well, like we previously talked about, the population is growing in Central Florida and East Central Florida by leaps and bounds. Florida has just been changed to the fourth most populated state in the United States. They're predicting that soon we will pass New York. We have thousands of people moving here every day. It's putting a stress on the fishery. We also, and that's just from an angling point of view, we also are having a problem with stormwater runoff because of all the number of houses, new houses that are being built on the water's edge. And that's creating a real pollution problem. For example, last year in the Banana River, which is probably the most populated shoreline area of the three lagoons, we had four different algae blooms at the same time in that river, and in 50-plus years, I've never heard of anything or seen anything like that here. So last summer, the water in the Banana River Lagoon was pea green for most of the summer, and the late part of the summer, it moved north into the no-motor zone where I fish a lot, and there are no buildings or houses on the shoreline there at all. So it's getting worse, but we're trying to handle it. We're trying to come up with ways to deal with it. It's just with so many people moving here new all the time, it's very hard to get a lot of people's attention and make them aware of just how bad the situation already is and their influence on whether it gets worse or not.
Yeah, I understand that that's a problem, that runoff is a problem, all the way down to the Keys as well. I was down there snorkeling, and I noticed the reef is dying down there a bit, and they said it's a lot of it's due to the fertilizer nitrogen and so
exactly.
forth runoffs.
That's a big problem here. Of course, a lot of the runoff here is from the roadways, too, so you're getting petroleum products in the water. But the majority of our problem is nitrogen and phosphorus, and the phosphorus is the real problem because the algae in the water feeds off of it, and as the algae grows, it absorbs more oxygen in the water, and of course fish need oxygen to breathe. So we have fish kills here every summer, usually around this time, August. They weren't too bad this year so far, but normally it's mostly catfish and mullet, but it can encompass the predators too at some time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those predators. What fish? You've mentioned a few of them, but when you go out with your customers, what fish do you primarily target?
Primarily, well, my favorite fish to chase is the red drum. In the wintertime, I like to chase the black drum in the no-motor zone. It's one of the few places around here that the bigger black drum that we have actually come up on the flats. We have some pretty large black drum, but they're not as big as they get up north of, you know, from all the way up to Chesapeake. Well, those black drum are twice the size of some of ours. But we get some monsters here. In the no-motor zone, the black drum that we see are probably at the biggest, the 35 to 40-pound range. But underneath those causeway bridges that I talked about a moment ago, they can get up to 90 pounds. But for some reason, those bigger ones do not come up on the flats. There's a couple areas in Mosquito Lagoon where they'll show up, too, but they're not really dependable. The no-motor zone wintertime black drum fishery is a lot more dependable. So I look forward to that every wintertime just to give me a break from the redfish. But primarily, most people that come here want to catch big redfish.
What's the major differences between those two fish? Is size one of the differences?
Well, behavior and size differences. They're all part of the croaker family, which spotted sea trout is too, by the way, and whiting. Redfish tend to be more aggressive. They're a little smarter than black drum, especially the big ones. They fight a lot harder. A big redfish, well, any redfish actually will pretty much try to kill himself to get away from you. The bigger ones are stronger and better at it, so you have to take more care in dealing with them and of course, use stouter gear. But the black drum, they're an uglier fish. I think they're beautiful, but some people think they're just downright ugly. They can come in three different colors. On the flats, I see black drum, jet black drum-like. I see gray drum, and I see, at times, orange black drum that some people many times mistake for redfish. Most of the time of the year, our redfish are pretty bronze-colored here because of all the streams and creeks and such that are running into the river all the time. We have a lot of tan in water. So you could pretty much tell where a redfish around here has come from recently by his color. If he's bronze, he's been in the river for a while. If they're lighter colored, they have come in from the ocean somewhere, either Ponce Inlet or to the south, Sebastian Inlet. They won't stay white long. They'll turn red pretty quick because we have a lot of tan in water, especially in our rainy season.
Now, there's a distinguishing mark redfish have. Can you describe that?
Well, yeah, they have spots. Black drum don't have spots, but redfish have a spot on their tail. It can be one or two or three or more. We see smaller redfish with 30 to 40 spots on them at times.
Oh, really?
It's an adaptation that it's just to fool predators and birds.
Yeah.
When they're smaller, it gives them a little better chance of surviving. It confuses the birds and the fish as to which end is going to run, which direction they're going to run into. As they get bigger, generally they start losing the spots. But for some reason in the Banana River, we have a lot more big redfish there with numerous amounts of spots on them as compared to the Indian River or the Mosquito Lagoon. Redfish in the Banana River have been caught in the 40-plus inch range with 30, 40 spots on.
Well, you always seem to see that picture of a redfish tail. Just the only thing you see is the tail sticking out of the water with that spot, you know?
Right.
So
well,
it's kind of
see one big spot on that tail. That picture you're looking at is probably a pretty small redfish from 30 inches or smaller.
Oh, okay. Okay,
as
good.
They get over that size, you know, into the 36, 40, 50-inch range, they either have no spots or they're pretty small.
Okay. Well, we need to take another break here real quick, Bob, so give me a few seconds, and we'll be right back. And we'll be talking to Bob more about this unique fishery and asking questions about it. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org, and is spelled out, so it's Reeling, A-N-D, Healing, Midwest, .org, or you could go to www.ifishon.org, that's the letter I, fishon.org, or call 866-237-5725, that's 866-237-5725. They'd sure appreciate your support. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bob Jaspers about sight fishing the flats of the Indian River Lagoon. If you'd like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A box there to send us your question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. Well, let's see here. We did get one of the questions that did come in over the Internet here, Bob, while we were talking is from Andrew Britton in Spring Hill, Florida, on the West Coast. He says, is it possible to use kayaks when fishing Mosquito Lagoon? You already said yes to that. He said, is there anything one should be aware of if they decide to fish from the kayak? So any tips from fishing from a kayak?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I would probably reiterate it on is the launching from the shoreline part. Be really careful where you launch from. I would suggest launching from established places where you can tell people have already launched before, because those are the places where the mud's going to be the easiest to get through. It's either that or just go to one of the boat ramps. We have concrete ran dirt ramps, and most of the dirt ramps around Mosquito Lagoon have areas right on the shore where you can just pull your kayak or canoe right in the water.
Okay. Getting in and out of the water could be a problem. What about once you're out there?
Right. Well, as far as fishing from a kayak, it's always better to be up high when you're sight fishing. And even if you're not really sight fishing, you're just kind of wandering around trying to run into fish schools or whatever, you're going to see more and better into the water the better or the higher the angle you are up in because it cuts the glare. And, of course, canoes are a little higher than kayaks, and kayaks are about as low down in the water as you can get. So it's almost impossible to sight fish the fish under the water in a kayak. You're pretty much regulated to movement that you see on top of the water, like tailing fish or schools moving. And it's just a matter of learning how to tell the difference of the size of fish to determine what you're looking at when you're seeing movement on top of the water. The best suggestion I can give to a kayak angler is go slow. When you get into the water, don't be inclined to move around a whole lot. Go to an area, sit there and watch for a bit, see if anything happening, if you're seeing bait moving. Generally, if there's no bait around, there's not going to be a lot of predators. And move from one spot to another slowly so that you give yourself time to see what's going on and you're not running over the fish before you see them.
Okay, good, good. Sounds like your preference would probably be to fish from a flats boat, though. So you could get that angle on the water.
Well, most people prefer flats boats, but kayaks are becoming very popular here in Florida. It's kind of surprising. For years, a lot of people didn't use them. But in the last 5 years, they are just booming here, and I'm seeing a lot more kayaks on the water. And it's actually a good thing. The kayak has its place. It's so maneuverable and easy for one angler to throw on the top of his car and go by himself. Some canoe anglers aren't very good at fishing out of a canoe by themselves, especially depending on how their canoe's laid out and rigged. So that gives a single angler an opportunity to get away from the shoreline that he might not otherwise have. Of course, a flats boat's great. It has its ups and downs, too. They burn gas. They're heavier and harder to pull around.
But hard to fish from by yourself.
That, too, yeah. Generally, when I fish in my boat, I'm on the poling platform, poling with a push pole with a fishing rod in one hand and poling with the push pole in my other hand. And if I see a fish, I'll put the push pole between my legs, and I have a better viewpoint. I can see the fish farther away than anybody else, even some angler on the front of my boat. And I have a casting platform on the front of my boat, too, but it's still not as tall as my poling platform. So you can catch fish by yourself, but, you know, it's a lot easier if it's not windy, so you can control the boat, you know, with just you in it. And you move slowly, you just take your time, and you're not probably going to want to move around really fast when you're pulling by yourself anyway. So they all have all the methods have their ups and downs, and they're all productive. So,
what about the movement of redfish and black drums? Are they, do they move in and out of areas during the day?
To some point, yeah. I guess I'll start with black drum first because that's going to be the easiest one to describe. I don't know about how black drum act in other areas of Florida. Where there's tides, I'm assuming they're going to act like every other fish. When the tide comes in, they're going to come in. When it goes out, they're going to leave. Here we don't have a tide, so basically what the black drum do here in the wintertime, the big ones, is they pretty much live underneath the bridges on the causeways where the water could be anywhere from 20 foot, more or less, deep. And they don't come out from underneath that bridge in the wintertime until the water temperature gets so cold that it reaches the depth that they're at down at the bottom that it's uncomfortable for them. Then they come up on the flats to warm up. They'll hide around or cruise around the grassy areas because they're dark and they'll warm up first. Redfish, they move around.
Before you go to redfish, can I assume then that the best time to get a big black drum on the fly is then maybe January or February?
Yeah, exactly. We can find, you know, some amounts of them in the winter months before that, but our coldest months here are January and February, and that's when it's really going to get cold to push those bigger fish out from under those bridges. We'll see smaller ones along a shoreline, you know, all during the winter. But the big ones, it takes some pretty good cold, you know, like 3 days of a freeze will really get them out from under those bridges.
And that's about as cold as it gets as a freeze down there, right?
Yeah, as cold as we want it to get.
Everything's relative, but it doesn't really get that cold.
We're freezing down here. You know, that's funny that you mention that because you adapt very quickly. You know, if a Floridian like myself, a native Floridian, was to go up north, it would probably take me one or two winter seasons, and I'd pretty much be adapted to it. The same thing goes for people that are from the north that move down here. When they first come, they say, it's not cold. 3 or 4 years later, they're freezing. So,
yeah.
talk
to us about the redfish then. And
well, the redfish move around a lot. Generally, they don't move. It's just a pretty given thought that redfish generally in Florida and most other areas don't normally move more than 2 to 5 miles from where they were born. I think in the Gulf of Mexico, that's probably not true because those fish are doing what redfish normally do. When they reach breeding size, they go out in the inlets and stuff in the oceans, and they rarely come back inshore. They'll come near shore by the beaches and the inlets, but they don't usually come back in the river, with the exception of a few in Mosquito Lagoon. There are some in Mosquito Lagoon that have been tagged and then found as far as the Carolinas. So you can usually tell those fish because they'll be very light-colored. And I don't think they stay in the Mosquito Lagoon as long as the local fish there do. Some of the Mosquito Lagoon fish leave, go through the Holliver Canal, and going into the Indian River to breed every summer. So I think there's two separate groups there, but for the most part, they generally stay within 5 miles of where they were born.
And being landlocked, they're pretty much, I take it, they do all their spawning in the lagoons there. Is that right?
Yes, they do. But most of the spawning takes place, as far as we know at this point, in the area north of Titusville, around Holliver Canal, and sometimes north and south of there. The fish will start schooling up in this spring and summer, early summer. And as farther we get into that schooling process and into summertime, the farther north they'll go. Historically, we've had a huge school of fish that gather there every year to spawn, and it can number in the hundreds. In years gone past, in the 60s, sometimes those fish numbered in the thousands. Some people still say they see that every year. I don't think there's that many big redfish right now. So you're probably talking about a school at its best yearly up there in the spawning stages of around 500 fish. I think each year lately, within the last 5 years, the school of big red seems to be getting smaller. I don't know why. If it's because more shore fishermen are keeping them because they're the ones that can get away with it. It's illegal to keep a redfish over 27 inches, but people do it. And some of it may be involved in the fishing pressure. No real studies have been done on that to prove that fishing pressure is affecting their spawning ability. But in the long range time that I've been here, spending 4 decades fishing, I have seen enough evidence to convince me that that's true, because a lot of the places I grew up fishing that had resident schools of big redfish no longer do, and that was caused obviously by my observations of pressure from anglers. So
I think that's pretty much all over the world.
We are trying to address that now. Some people are fighting that. Some people are refusing to believe it's true. I think they're doing it to serve their own purposes, and that includes some guides. But
Well, does time of year have anything to do with larger redfish, like the drums coming up on the
Well, we
the
do
flats?
Have that spawning period. They start gathering up June, July, and August. They'll breed in the river from September to October, and sometimes on into as late as the end of the year in December. I think most of it's pretty much done by October. I don't myself personally target that big school of redfish. I don't like fishing the breeders in that time of the year because I don't want to affect their spawning. But no, you can find big redfish all year long. It's just a matter of knowing where to look, and that's basically on drop-off areas of the edges of flats. Big redfish don't really like to get up in shallow flats in areas where they would have to take a long time to get back to the deep water. And I think that's just a genetic memory thing that they've learned over the years, that to survive and get to that age, you have to be able to escape. So they will stay by the edge of the flats, either on the flat or right off of it on the drop-off. And in many places, they'll hang around, A lot of the redfish now have become kind of numb to the boats and the pressure. So some places they just sit there and take it, and sometimes for months. Other places, the flat may not be as big, and the fish may be a little more spooky from boat traffic or something like that, and you catch one fish and the school's gone. So, but I catch big redfish all through the winter in the no motor zone. So, and there, I know there are places up around Holliver Canal in the north part of the Indian River where you can do the same, because I've done it up there my whole life too.
So would you say the season is better during the winter? And
Not necessarily. Spring and fall are generally the best fishing times for everything here. It has to do with the mullet runs and the bait availability and the lack of it, and at certain times, and water temperatures. They don't like it really too hot, They don't like it when it's too cold. So spring and fall is probably the most comfortable times for them as far as water temperatures go. But you can catch them all year long.
And what's a big redfish for you, Bob?
A big redfish to me is anything over 36 inches.
And that's what you try to take your clients after?
Right. A lot of time, in the Mosquito or No Motor Zone, in the wintertime, I'm putting anglers on redfish that are anywhere from 40 to 50 inches in schools. And they school a little differently. They school a little differently in the No Motor Zone than they do in, like, Mosquito Lagoon. For example, right now in the north part of the river in Mosquito Lagoon, they're schooling up and have been for a while. In No Motor Zone, this time of year, they really don't school that much. The big fish, I see more of them in bigger schools in the wintertime in the cold water. We'll see more smaller slot and smaller size redfish in the warmer months like now. But,
okay.
Of course, that corresponds with low water and spooky fish. So,
let's switch for just a second. We have a question from Kevin Brady in Coatesville, Pennsylvania. And you had mentioned earlier that one of the fish you also target is sea trout. And Kevin asks, what exactly is a sea trout? The term as it applies to fish in Texas seems to be used in a completely different way than it is in the Northeast. Are these fish actually trout? Can you describe their behavior and feeding patterns? Also, what is their range?
Right. Let me start at the beginning. What we call a sea trout here is actually an eastern spotted sea trout. It is not the same thing as the weak fish that they catch up in the Northeast Atlantic area. They are related genetically, but they're not the same thing. There are a lot more bigger weak fish up there than we have big sea trout here, although our sea trout do get big. We don't have as many big ones as we used to have here. The best way to probably tell them apart is our spotted sea trout have less spots than a weak fish, but they're bigger. And they have, in some cases, a yellow mouth. And that's
now, are these really similar cool. to the trout in Texas?
It's the same fish.
Okay.
Once you get up to North Georgia and the Carolinas is where you start seeing the weak fish. The whole Gulf area from Texas to Florida is pretty much a spotted sea trout. And they're not really a trout. They, again, are a member of the croaker family, like the drum, the red drum and the black.
Ah, okay. And do you fish for them differently? Do they act differently than the redfish and the drums?
Well,
and the black drums?
Some people think differently. Sea trout is a very spooky fish. They are the spookiest fish on the flats we have here. They will not take any noise whatsoever. Motor of a boat, anything like that, too much noise on the flat, and they are gone. Redfish are more forgiving. Black drum are even more forgiving. Black drum, I don't think, are as smart as redfish are. But sea trout just will not put up with any noise. They'll hit just about any lure that you would fish for a redfish with. They're very aggressive. They're more of a impulse fish where even if they're not necessarily hungry, if something's in their face, they're going to grab it. A sea trout can eat, for instance, a sea trout can eat a fingerling mullet a third of its size. And sometimes they're such gluttons because of their aggressiveness that they will actually try to catch something way bigger than that and choke themselves to death. So it's not uncommon for people that have been here a long period of time to actually see big redfish floating around with a fish sticking out of its mouth where he's choking. See, they have two canine teeth on the top of their mouth, and when a fish comes in, it doesn't come out, and they can't shake it out.
Uh-huh. So
eventually, they suffocate and drown.
Oh, my God.
And so does the fish in their mouth. So.
Jeez. Well, Bob, we need to take another little break here. When we return, we'll talk about equipment, flies, and tactics here and try to finish up with that about how to catch these big redfish and black drums. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com for more information. Okay, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bob Jaspers about sight fishing the flats of the Indian River Lagoon. If you'd like to ask Bob a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below Bob's section in the Q&A box there and type in your question and send it to us. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll answer as many of them on the show as possible tonight. Okay, Bob, we're running out of time, so we'll have to move quickly here. Let's just quickly talk about equipment, rods, lines, reels, anything unusual or different here, and what do you suggest a person bring down there?
Fly rods, you can go anywhere from a 5-weight to a 9-weight here, but you have to be careful what you target with the smaller weight rods. If you're going to fish with anything less than an 8-weight, you need to be fishing small snook, small trout, and very small redfish, and that's about it. When you start getting into the bigger fish, I recommend a 9-weight, and that's pretty much all I carry. I bring on my boat with me usually 2 9-weights and a 10-weight in case I run into some tarpon that are good size, which doesn't happen that long, but I'm waiting for it. Last year I had an angler. We ran across some tarpon that ran in the 100-pound range, and I had a guy catch about 130-pound tarpon on one of my 9-weights. So, that was a bit overkill, but for most fish in the river, big redfish, big black drum, big snook, 9-weight's a pretty good size.
And, again, Kevin Brady from Coatesville, Pennsylvania asked, is there any advantages to underweighting your gear when fishing the flats, like using,
none whatsoever that I can think of. Most of these fish are pretty strong. I wouldn't recommend doing that because...
it's hard on the fish, right?
It's obviously hard on the fish. A big redfish, like I said before, will try to kill himself to get away. In the summertime, when the oxygen levels are low, they can kill themselves. So I try to promote using tackle stout enough for the species and the size of species that you're trying to target. Of course, you can catch any size redfish on a 9-weight. It's not going to be as lively and as fun as it's going to be on a 6 or a 7 or something like that. But I wouldn't throw at a big redfish with a 6-weight.
Okay.
Under lining, you're going to end up, if you catch something big, watching your line break and a fish swim out with 50 to 100 yards of fly line in his mouth. It just, or a leader, depending on where it breaks at.
Right, right. And any specific recommendations on reels, line?
Reels, I don't think reels are real important. I think, everybody has their favorite. Some people like to spend a lot of money on reels. Some people don't have the money to spend. I think you just need to find a reel that has a good drag and is saltwater resistant. And that's pretty much all I like all kinds of reels. I fish with Lamson reels and Scientific Angler reels. And
what about backing?
Backing? You can use anything from, spun dichron to braided line. Some people here use braided line now for backing because it's so strong and they can get more on their reel. Generally, I suggest about 200 yards of backing, 30-pound backing. I fish with nothing but large arbor spools so I can get a lot of line on and I get the line back fast.
And what about, I take it you use mostly floating lines?
Pretty much. I have a few intermediate lines, but I rarely use them on the flats. It's just not deep enough where you need those. The only thing you really have to worry about on the floating line is, of course, laying it over the fish's back. If they don't see it, and you're good with your presentation, the only thing that's going to get near them is a leader anyway. But intermediate lines are good for deeper water places around docks and the inlets and stuff. But on the flats where I'm generally fishing less than 3 foot of water, I can affect where my fly goes by as simple as weight. The difference between a clouser and a deceiver, Of course, if you're fishing a foot of water, you really don't need lead eyes on a fly. If you're in a couple feet of water and the fish are moving quickly, you might want it to get down a little quicker and add, lead eyes like a clouser on there. I fish with both. I bring both with me. So, and I fish with a lot of crab flies too that aren't weighted. And it's all bait.
Any particular leader or tippet set up? Do you need a bite tippet at all, or just?
I don't think you do. Some people like to do it, but then again, when you put a bite tippet on there, you're just kind of admitting that you might be defeated and broken off and leave your hook in a fish's mouth. I don't like to do that. So I think if you use stout enough stuff that's not so stout it's going to break your rod, you have a better chance of getting the fish to the boat quicker and reviving and moving on to another fish. One thing to take into consideration is the fact the longer that you keep that fish on the line, the more fish around him he's going to scare, too. So that's something to think about.
What kind of pound test do you use for your leader?
Well, I start out usually on a leader that I tie, I will start out with like a 40-pound butt section, go to 30, then to 20. I may or may not put a shock leader in there. Usually don't. I like three-piece leaders. And I'll even use a store-bought tapered leader. I don't think it's that important as long as you have one strong enough for the fish that you're throwing at. You don't want to keep getting broke off all the time. And I've noticed with, you know, I let my anglers bring their own fishing gear if they want. And some of them, you know, tie their own leaders. And I've noticed when I first started chartering that a lot of them were under lining the tippets. So I kind of developed a three-piece leader. It ends up in a 20-foot piece, and I can tie knots with that fairly well.
Okay, let's talk about food sources and flies here. Just real quickly, what are the primary food sources that are available to these fish? What do they feed on?
We have all kinds of bait here. We have everything from finger mullet, which could be 3 to 8 inches long. That's a primary food source of a trout. Small redfish, when they're small, in, you know, like pre-slot flies, slot being 18 to 27 inches, most of their food is shrimp and crab. When they start getting over like the 20, 24-inch range, they'll start eating bait fish. A big redfish will eat anything, crabs, blue crabs, clams, oysters, moderate amount of bait fish from redfin herring to mud minnows, or the tarpon food, the glass minnows. I see them eating those too, so they're just opportunities. All of them are bottom feeders, so you got to realize they're looking on the bottom, but if anything comes too close to their face, they'll take it dead or alive.
Okay. Z. Zarenge in Louisiana asks, if you're fishing in heavy grass, does that affect your fly selection? And does it change areas where the grass is not as thick? What type of weed guard do you prefer? So basically he's asking, you know, is there something special you use in heavy grass, and do you use weed guards?
Right. Normally, no. The only difference I use is flies without weed guards and flies with weed guard. Being a stiff piece of mono or fluorocarbon, like Lamoy, which is pretty stiff. You have that option. You can put a weed guard on there. I always carry flies with and without them, the same flies, so, and I carry a myriad amount of different flies with me. I have flies that I like more than others, of course, but I bring 10 times more with me than I need of all kinds of stuff. You have an option to use bend back, hooks too on your flies too, but I suggest you make sure you have a pretty good size hook on that, because the bigger fish, they need some gap.
So what flies would be your go-to flies there for the drums?
I like I mentioned before, I like clousers and deceivers. I use mostly those in different colors. I use crab flies and some shrimp flies. I don't usually use a whole lot of shrimp flies. For one thing, they don't fly real well, but neither do crab flies, but I seem to get better reaction with the bigger fish from the crab flies. So black drum like crab flies, but they'll eat a clouser. They'll eat a deceiver. They're more interested in color and presentation. Both redfish and black drum.
Now, you said they're mostly feeding off the bottom, so I take it topwater stuff probably isn't that effective.
It works, you know, depending on the depth. For example, if you're fishing for big red fish in 3 to 4 foot of water, and they're really hungry, and it's a good, you know, there's more aggressiveness with the larger number of fish in a school, you know. So, of course, you're going to have a more aggressive situation when you've got 20 fish than if you've got three. But they'll hit poppers. I have mixed, you know, some people really like to use them. I use them sometimes. When the water's really calm, I go with the really small ones. But unfortunately, their hooks are small, and a lot of times they pull out. The big ones are okay, but sometimes they're hard to throw in the wind. So I try to use something else first.
And what are there particular kinds of hooks that you like to use for your clousers or your deceivers?
Not really. I'm not particular about hook brands or anything. I like them sharp. I bend the barbs down on everything that I use.
Short shank, I take it? Or?
I use a longer shank hook if I'm going to create something with a bend back.
Okay.
But generally, no, I'm not picky. I'm more particular about the size of the hook. I like to fish for big fish hooks between size 2 and up to 3-aught hooks.
And, okay.
And some people think I'm crazy, but big black drumming, big red fish have some pretty thick lips, and I like the hook to get around it and not be stuck in the lip.
Yeah, okay. What about colors? Any particular colors that work better?
Well, my favorite color is chartreuse for everything, to be honest. Generally consensus is you, in the darker parts of the early day and morning, you use darker colors, and as the sun comes up, you can go to brighter colors. But I've had pretty good luck with chartreuse in the morning, too, so it just depends. If it's not working, I'll switch to a darker fly. In the wintertime, I will hook up one rod with like a crab and the other one with like a dark crab-type fly or a clouser or a deceiver in browns, more earth-tone browns, maybe dark earthy-colored greens, combinations of with tans and browns in there. That way, both redfish and a black drum will hit that. Black drum aren't really into bright-colored flies, although they'll hit them. For a long time, people here thought you could only catch them with black flies. I catch a lot more with brown flies, different shades of brown on the same fly. And you can catch just about anything on chartreuse if you.
Okay.
It's just presentation.
Let's talk about presentation and strategy and technique. Can you one of the questions that came in is, can you describe the perfect conditions out there, wind direction, speed, water temperature, clarity? What would be your perfect day out there in the lagoon?
Well, to me, I like perfectly calm, flat days. Some people like a little wind on the water. It helps keep the fish calmer. I personally like it to be just flat as glass and calm as glass so I can see them from far enough away and sneak up on them. I like to get close to the fish so my anglers can see what they're looking at or see what they're fishing for. And I will get up to like 20 feet, as close as 20 feet to a school of fish if they will let me and not freak out. If they freak out, I let them calm down and I'll get closer again, but not quite that close again. It depends on the angler and his casting skill, basically.
But you don't have to make 60, 70-foot casts in general.
No, I know some people here that think you do, but especially in a canoe. A canoe is a lot quieter, and a kayak is a lot quieter boat than a flats boat. Flats boats, you're up higher, and so they can see you, too. You got to realize when you can see the fish, they can see you, too. So in a canoe or a kayak, you're less visible to them.
Let's say we're going out. What are we looking for as we head out into the lagoon? What kind of water? Is there anything? Are we looking
I like
for birds
water.
Or?
I like pardon? Clear water. Birds, nah, it's really not an issue. Bait is an issue. If you get in the water and you don't see any bait around for an hour, you're probably not going to see much of anything.
When you say bait, are you saying just looking in the water? Are you saying top water activity of the bait?
Yeah, because the water is so shallow, you can see all the bait on top of the water. They'll move in. Mullet will move in schools, big mullet, little mullet. They all move in schools. In the heat of the summer, there's not enough oxygen in the water, so they'll actually stick their head out of the water and breathe out of the surface, and you can definitely tell them then. everything down to glass minnows kind of schools up in little schools, and you know, you can see them spook, and they'll spook it themselves more than anything else. You'll see fish jumping out of the water. You could tell when it's a predator making them that happen because there'll be a splash, but nine times out of ten, they're just spooking themselves, so they give themselves away a lot. And I'm a believer in you have to have bait. If you want a lot of predators to be around, there's got to be bait.
Once we find the bait, then what's our next step then?
Looking for the predators. Redfish don't really like the tail too much when it's windy, especially when it's really windy. So calmer conditions there that you have, the more chance you're going to see tails and backs of dorsal fins of redfish coming out of the water. And you can see them on a calm day a mile away. So you can almost pick your targets. You can see single fish, double fish, five fish pop out of the water. When you're talking big fish, generally if you see two or three tails pop up, there's a lot more underneath the water than what you're seeing. So that's
okay, now I've seen a tail. I've seen a tail out there. I think it's a big fish. Well, what's your approach and presentation then with the cast?
Well, I try to approach the fish from the side. Some people think the optimum angle is when the fish is coming at you, and that can be good too, but some people freak out when that happens. So if you give an angler a side cast, they can usually throw it 2 to 3 feet in front of the fish and maybe 3 or 4 feet beyond them and then drag it in front of them. What you don't want to do is have any kind of lure or fly going at a predator's face because they will run. Predators do not attack, are not attacked by bait, and they know it. So as soon as a bait fish comes at them, their radar goes up, and they'll run for the horizon. So you want to have it at some kind of like a 45 or 90-degree angle coming away from them.
And that's critical, that presentation part of it, right?
Oh, yeah. There's a fine line. You have to get it close enough but not so close that it scares them. And every situation can be different. The more fish there are, the closer you can get without scaring them. But you got to realize, you want to do it in like 2 back casts or less because they're going to see that fly line flying above their head. So I try to get my anglers close enough to them, have them pre-strip enough line out, maybe 30 yards, and they'll never use it, but it's there if they need it. And 1 or 2 casts and lay it down, It's funny that half the time on the second cast towards the fish, it's perfect, but yet 9 times out of 10, the angler will go for that 3rd back cast, and that's when they spook. So that's one thing I really drill into them is 2 back casts maximum, Sometimes anglers like to sit there with the fly in their hand and be ready. I try to have them have the leader out of the fly rod and actually standing on the front of the boat, just kind of flipping the leader and the fly back and forth to the left, keeping it in the air, moving a little bit. And if something pops up in front of them, they've got the leader moving. They can put it out there quickly. If it's not there, they can strip, pick it back up if the fish is within 20 feet or so, and put it right back down again. And a lot of times with black drum, that's very effective. Redfish, you hit the water around them too many times with a fly, they might run off. But a black drum, he can be 5 feet in front of the boat and not even see you or react to you. And on that 5th presentation, he'll grab it.
We've got a question from Rod Rashiers in Texas. And he said, here's his question. This came in on the Internet while we were talking. What would be the best way to practice fast, accurate casts that are needed for sight fishing? I had an awful time in Rockport, Texas, sight fishing for reds with a Nazi guide screaming, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, quick, quick, quick. And then he says, practice is the mother of all skills. So it sounds like he had a pretty demanding guide there.
Well, there's a pretty tough learning curve for fly fishing in this area because all of our casts normally aren't as far away as they are in a lot of their places. Still, I see a lot of people that close having problems with close presentation. The best thing I could tell him is practice in the water. And that doesn't mean standing in the water, but which is good practice. Stripping into the water is probably picking up that fly line. A 9 weight is one of the hardest things to do. If you can master standing in the water waist deep, stripping in the water, and pick it up quick and present it quick, then when you're in a boat, you're ahead of the game. But I don't really I mean, it doesn't hurt to practice on dry land, but it's not really, when you have to pick a fly line out of the water, it's a whole other ball game. So,
you have that whole surface tension going on.
Yeah, what I like to use is stripping baskets, strip in a boat or a canoe, strip it into the basket, have the line ready, and just be standing there watching. If you practice when there's no fish around, I always make my fly anglers throw a bunch of practice casts as soon as we get on the water to get familiar with the equipment, whether it's theirs or mine. And so when we do see fish, they know what to expect and what is expected of them. Every guide says 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock. Some guides get mean and mad about it, and some don't. I don't. To me, it's all about fun. If you're not having fun, why be there? So I will never yell at anybody. But,
okay. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know.
Guys down in the Keys tend to get a little touchy about it. The thing you have to remember about guides is they all want pictures for their website. So they want you to catch fish, but they can get a little overzealous. I want you to have fun first.
Well, on that note, it's time to wrap things up, and unfortunately, we haven't yet gotten to all the questions for any guests, so this is no different than any other night, but yet we have to close things up here. So when we return, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, so stay tuned. And for those of you, get ready, that have the answer to my question coming up. So here we go. We're going to take just a little break, and we'll be right back. The largest and most prestigious fly fishing competition in the United States, the National Fly Fishing Championship, will take place in Colorado during the first week of October. The National Fly Fishing Championship, sponsored by Colorado Trout Unlimited and the fly fishing industry, involves teams from different regions of the country, Fly Fishing Team USA, and international competitors. The payoff is gold, silver, and bronze medals, and an opportunity to be selected as a member of Team USA, who will represent our country in the 2008 World Championships in New Zealand. Volunteers are needed. Interested parties may apply online at www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. That's www.nationalflyfishingchampionship.com. From our global events calendar, we see that on Saturday, October 6th, beginning around 10 a.m., Royal Gorge Anglers in Canyon City, Colorado, will be hosting their second annual Fall Play Day. It's called October Fish, and it combines Oktoberfest, Bratfest, Fishing Fest, and Fun Fest, all held in the Arkansas River KOA campground, 1 mile east of Cotopaxi on Highway US 50. This year's event will be sponsored by Wright & McGill of Denver, Colorado. And they're going to offer a full day of fun and casting lessons for everyone, beginner as well as advanced, and even spay casting with classes with Al Noriker of Wright & McGill and the staff of the Royal Gorge Anglers. Around 2 p.m., they'll cook brats, so bring your favorite beverage and have some fun. So go to our global events calendar on our website. The link is near the bottom of most every page on our site, and look in under U.S. and then Colorado for more information. Fly shops and clubs, you can list your fly fishing events in our global events calendar. It's free. You can do it yourself. Just go to the global events calendar and get started. Just a quick reminder, everybody, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that said, "What did you think of our show?" Just click on that link and leave your comments. Well, now it's time to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Always a great gift to give away. And to be involved in this drawing, you'll have to have registered already on our site. If you didn't, it's a little late now. But next time, be sure you do that ahead of time so that you can participate in these drawings and pick up one of these great gifts. So I'm going to press our magic button, and the winner is Teresa Adams in California. I think Teresa has won before, but that shows you, hey, the people that register get the prizes. And then we're going to also give away that gift, Fly Fusion Magazine, a 1-year subscription to that. And I press my magic button, and I get Chad Scheel, and he's in Colorado. So congratulations to the two of you. We'll contact you after the show about how to get your gifts, and So we'll email you asking for your information about that. Now, the question is, for those of you listening online, the question is, and be ready to type the answer in that box, first answer that comes through will be the winner, what is the distinctive marking that a redfish has that makes it easily identifiable? So go ahead and submit your answers, and we'll take the first one that comes in. And while we're waiting on that, Bob, just wanted to thank you. We really appreciate you spending time with us tonight and talking about this very unique fishery. And I'm glad we had the chance, and I hope we can do it again sometime in the future.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and looks like we got an answer. It says Rick Johnson in Tallahassee, Florida. He knows about those spots, so Rick Johnson gets the $20 gift certificate. And Rick, if you will type in your email address and send it back through on that again, then I'll email you later on how you're going to get your gift certificate. So thanks for participating. We appreciate that. On our next broadcast, which will be on September 19th at 7 p.m., Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That show will interview Jason Borger, and our topic for the show will be casting, mending, and presentation for difficult angling situations. The challenge of fly fishing can increase dramatically when conditions become difficult, whether it be due to weather, water, cover, hatches, distance, or a combination of those factors. When the angling gets tough, it pays to have a few tricks up your sleeve. So learn from Jason about ways to make difficult angling situations easier and more productive. Be sure to visit our site and ask questions for Jason in advance. We'd love to have those questions. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Pierre Marquette River Lodge, Reeling and Healing Midwest, and Power Fibers Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. And don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com. Make sure you're signed up to receive all our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.